Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 133, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
And me, Ravi Abbott.
On our first show of August. 8 months into 2018. You know, I've got a nightmare that I'm going to wake up like tomorrow and it's going to be like 2055 and I'll be in the nursing home.
And you'll still be doing the Retro Hour.
Yeah, trying to wire up my old
Amiga. I'm Dan Wood.
Get off my lawn. Yeah. But of course, we have got a very busy month coming up now. Next week is now. Be on the train, London bound.
Oh, God, I can't wait, man. These guests that we've got coming to play London and the panels that people are going to see are just going to be insane. I can't believe we're doing a nightmare one for a start. That's just awesome.
This is going to be massive. Next week, the ultimate retro gaming show, Play Expo, lands in London. First show that we've done in the capital, this, isn't it? At the Printworks. Now, it's happening next weekend on the 11th and 12th of August. If you've never been to a Play Expo event before, I'd say make this the one that you come to.
Definitely. This is going to be the big one, isn't it? Because we're launching in the capital. And also, there's going to be Play Blackpool as well later this year. So there's two events going on, one up north and one in the capital.
And we are the official podcast of Play Expo. So we do all the talks there throughout the weekend. And I think we're doing about, is it like four a day, isn't it? Four on Saturday.
Yeah.
We've got a week to prep. It'll be fine.
Oh, the Oliver twins run it themselves.
But we've got Archie McLean's going to be joining us as well. And you remember like international karate, Archie McLean's pool, Jimmy White's World One Snooker.
Oh, yeah, that was one of the best old school accurate pool games, wasn't it?
And we got the Sega artist Duncan Gutteridge, who's going to do workshops on how to draw Sonic.
Oh, cool.
If you ever wanted to know that. The Oliver twins are going to be there as well.
John Hare.
Yeah, Mike Montgomery from the Bitmap Brothers, who we've done like, we did a show with Mike years ago on the show, didn't we, when we first started?
Yeah.
And we hung around with them, Amiga 30, I think it was, in Peterborough.
He's such a nice dude. And, you know, he knows all about those titles because Bitmap basically went from the Amiga onto kind of PC and onto PlayStation stuff, but then kind of died off. But they had some awesome titles. Do you remember Zed?
Oh, yeah. Z? Chaos Engine?
Yeah.
What a legendary game. So, cannot wait to do that panel. First time we've done a panel with him as well. I think it's going to be really cool. Mr. Biffo, if you watch Digitizer on Teletext back in the day, he's relaunched that as like a new video kind of format. So,
well, he's got a whole show, hasn't he?
Yeah.
He's got like hosts and they're filming live at the moment. It's going to be interesting to see that.
And Andrew Hewson, the founder of Hewson Consultants, legendary label back in the 80s, is back now. Games like Iridium, Cybernoid, Paranoid, Exelon, Nebulous.
This is interesting because we've had Rob Hewson on before, who is the kind of younger son who's continuing the company now. But having Andrew is just fantastic because it's like the original Hewson back.
Well, even like 21st Century Entertainment, he did after that Pinball Fantasy.
Yeah.
Pinball Dreams, yeah, those were amazing games. And finally, on our stage at the Play Expo event next weekend, we're going to have a panel all about Nightmare.
Oh, yes, and we have got some experts from Nightmare.com joining us as well. So it's going to be really good fun, that one is.
Well, we've got Hugo, who played Treyguard on Nightmare. Now, for anyone outside the UK, you can actually watch most of Nightmare on YouTube, I think. Most episodes are on there. And this was, I mean, it was kind of a Dungeons & Dragons kind of game, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was on kids' TV. It was kind of for the kids, but I loved it, you know. And it had all that traditional kind of role-play element of go forwards, go left, and, you know, a team directing a character in a dungeon.
But it was all computer-generated as well. And you think Nightmare began in 1987, and it ran for 112 episodes. Those graphics for the day were groundbreaking.
Yeah, first time
you'd ever seen anything like that.
Talking about that, they must have spent ages on it.
Do you remember, like, the walls would come to life and start talking and everything, wouldn't they? It was nuts, and I can't wait to meet Traegard. I'm going to be the most starstruck I've ever been.
Wait for Dan's selfie with Traegard. That's going to
Or at least one set. There's going to be loads of selfies with Traegard, I'm sure. So if you haven't got a ticket yet, it's going to be happening next weekend in London. Play Expo. We are so excited about this at the Printworks. And if you can't make it down, of course, we will be broadcasting some of the panels from Play Expo on the Retro Hour podcast in coming weeks and on YouTube as well. So keep an eye out for that.
Sure, there'll be videos everywhere.
Now, on this week's show, we do have an interesting guest from back in the day, Alternative Software.
Yes, we have Roger Hulley from Alternative Software, and these guys have been going for 33 years. Can you believe that? They're still going throughout all the changes of technology, of programs, and they're actually doing a re-release of School Days, which is one of the original old school games.
And that is an achievement, 33 years in the computer and gaming industry. Yeah, I mean, he started when it was like, you know, Atari VCS consoles and then obviously Spectrums and Commodore 64s with cassette duplication that he did at home actually for a while, didn't he? Set his own duplication plant up. And now they're still going, releasing iPhone games and on Steam. So what a change he's seen in 33 years of this industry.
Totally. And we're going to be talking about School Days, which is your classic kind of British game here. It's got the elements of Grange Hill, the Bus Street kids, and all these naughty school kids in a very sensible, posh British school where they pea shoot the teachers. It's great.
All the things you wanted to do at school but you could never get away with, you could do in this game, couldn't you?
Wreck the chalkboards, just run around everywhere.
But I loved Alternative as well. You mean, as a kid growing up with, like, you know, didn't get much pocket money. The fact they released games like Mastertronic as well were the same, and Codemasters.
Yeah, I think he said they own 19% of the market, of the budget market at the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's understandable because those were the games that you could afford with your own pocket money. So they did a big service to kids back in the 80s and 90s. So looking forward to this one. Roger Hulley from Alternative Software is going to be this week's special guest on the Retro Hour podcast. We'll be talking to him in about 15 minutes from now. Now, we have got some new stories that you're going to find really interesting in just a minute. We're going to talk about Andy Warhol's Amiga. There's been a new development on that that you might not be too happy with, Revy. And also, Craig Charles did a Nintendo video that's been rediscovered. Possibly not the proudest moment of his career, but we'll talk more about that in just a second.
Oh, God, I've seen worse.
But of course, if you do want to keep the Retro Hour podcast going week in, week out, we do rely on your donations to help us out with the running of the show. Every penny, every pound, every euro, every dollar, every cent that we get into the pot all goes back into the running of the Retro Hour. And you can make a donation if you'd like to. We do say all the time, it's a tip jar. It is completely optional, but if you'd like to put something in there, it does really help us out a lot.
Any currency, any cryptocurrency, you know, it's all available on our site.
Yeah, so all you've got to do is head to theretrohour.com. There's a PayPal link up there as well. And just for making a donation, big or small, they're all big in our heart, aren't they?
Definitely.
You'll find your place in the Retro Hour Hall of Fame. Just like this week, thank you so much to Mark Heslop.
Darren Coles.
Patrick McGinty
and Ben Litchfield,
who all made donations into the running of the Retro Hour podcast, and you can do the same at theretrohour.com. I love Craig Charles.
Craig Charles. Yeah, I love Craig Charles. He was like my hero when I was a kid. I thought he was absolutely amazing as Lister. Because if you remember, he did that anarchistic poetry, wasn't he? He was like, I'm an anarchist. Yeah, that's how he kind of started out. And then it was on Channel 4. I think it was on the Ben Elton show. It was a really late night one. And then he kind of got into sci-fi. And he became the default guy for computers at one point, didn't he? He was like, oh, God, on those awful medieval 3D show where you had to control troops and no one knew what was going on. And Craig Charles was running around like, there's a battalion coming.
And then Robot Wars, of course.
Yeah, Robot Wars after that, yeah.
Well, it turns out that in 1993, I mean, you remember the Super Mario All-Stars pack?
I totally remember the All-Stars pack because I had that choice. I came into the shop when I was a kid and my dad was like, right, you can buy this stuff. And I'd always wanted Nintendo because I'd seen it. And there was an Amiga CD32, a PlayStation, and an All-Stars pack, Mario All-Stars. So I was like, I don't care about Amiga anymore. Mario All-Stars. And my dad said, well, it's a cartridge. You're not getting that. Get the PlayStation. And it was a wise move, Dad.
In hindsight, yeah, yeah.
But it was appealing till really late on, actually.
And even now, if I see one of the All-Stars packs at like a retro gaming event, you look at it and it had great artwork, didn't it? And visually, it just looked like such a great product. But, I mean, it turns out it didn't sell itself. In 1993, Nintendo UK hired Craig Charles to promote the Super Mario All-Stars pack.
So this was a promotional video that Craig Charles did, and I guess this would maybe be put in stores and stuff like that. You wouldn't have got it with the All-Stars pack.
No, which is weird to think of because, I mean, in the UK back then, we had four TV channels. Channel 1, 2, 3 and 4, that was it. BBC 1, 2, ITV and Channel 4. And it's not like now, or like it was in America back then, where overnight you kind of get like, you know, promotional videos playing all night on telly, wouldn't you? You didn't really get that here. I mean, TV stations used to close down at like midnight, 1 in the morning,
yeah, didn't they? And you know, Craig Charles was the bee's knees then because he was in Red Dwarf, which was like the hottest thing around.
Yeah, but I imagine they'd have had these playing in shops. Or I remember getting an Apple promotional video that you'd have to like send off a format of a magazine, the post to it in the mail.
It's probably Nintendo thought, right, we need to shift these. How are we going to do that? We can't hire staff to go in. Let's do a video with Craig Charles and play that. That'll get the kids' attention.
Well, do you want to hear a little bit of this video featuring Craig Charles? Now, this has been uploaded by a Nintendo fan called Chris Scully, and he's put this on YouTube, ripped it from VHS. And here is Craig Charles in the 1993 Nintendo UK promo.
In a Nintendo spaceship.
Of course.
Right then, thrill seekers, here we go. We've got some amazing insider information for you game wizards. Not off. We've got reviews of the latest games and what the experts think of those games. We've got a visitor hotline city and what it all means. The Mario story, where, why and how did a little Italian with a moustache become a worldwide superstar? We've got tips and tricks on the latest software and we get to the bottom of how the game's writers invent a Super Nintendo game. And we look at some of the excellent gear that you...
Obviously all sponsored by Nintendo. I can't imagine many of the games get bad reviews in this, if I'm honest.
Well, I think this is quite interesting because they talk about the hotline.
Yeah.
Nintendo hotline. Now, that was just a thing to make money out of kids, wasn't it? You know, the tips and cheats hotline. So obviously they're trying to turn it into a big thing. Oh, I've got to ring the experts. You know, I bet that was like pound a minute or something.
Well, back then you couldn't just Google it though, could you?
No, you couldn't. No, it was schoolyard knowledge or... rich kid ringing the hotline, I guess.
Or go on Games Master.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, you didn't have many other options to get the cheats for the games then. But I love that. I mean, that is so 90s marketing, isn't it, watching that video?
Oh, yeah. And just the phrases that you gaming wizards and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. It is amazing. And I mean, even just watching that clip there, I just want to sit down and watch that whole video now. It's about
I just want to remix it. That would be good.
Yeah, get one of your Amiga decks with those Craig Charles mods on there. But the 90s, it was such a great time for marketing. Do you remember Rick Mayall? Nintendo promos as well.
Yeah, totally. They were crazy, yeah.
And obviously you had like a Sega Pirate TV, and it just seemed so exciting back then, the video game marketing. So yeah, it's nice to see a bit of that preserved on YouTube.
Totally. I guess now they leave the YouTubers just to do it for them.
It does all seem a bit safe and corporate these days, their video game marketing, doesn't it?
It does.
I mean, we had that one with, you know, Sonic Mania, the recent promo they did of that. That's kind of a throwback to the old days.
Yeah, that was really interesting, yeah. Seeing the kind of old VHS style that they did, and they fully recreated all of that, didn't they?
Bring back that Attitude era, I think, of video games.
Chewed. We want chewed.
Turn your baseball cap backwards. Yeah. Right, let's talk about something that you're not going to like, Ravi. Someone's butchered an Amiga 1000.
They haven't. This is the thing. Dan sent me this, like, they've butchered the Amiga 1000. I was like, what the hell? They've butchered it. But they haven't. Basically, this is the Andy Warhol Museum. Now, Andy Warhol had lots of Amigas for touring.
Okay.
So he had decommissioned parts. Now, I don't know what decommissioned means. Maybe they've looked at it and they've gone, this is decommissioned, and then just chucked it when it could be repaired.
Well, let's give a bit of background for people who might not know. What's the connection between Andy Warhol, who's a famous artist in the 80s, Campbell's Soup?
A very famous artist, and basically Amiga came out and it was the machine with many colours. Mm. I think it was 14 million colours or something like that. So Andy Warhol basically used, I think it was Graphicraft, which was the early one, and when the Amiga was launched, he did a bit of Amiga art, capturing Deborah Harry.
Yeah, at the launch event, wasn't
it? At the launch, yeah. So he did that, and he had a few of these machines. So the Andy Warhol Museum have got hold of these. Now, they've kind of butchered it. Like, I work in the art and museum industry, and we have a very strict rule in the UK, which is if you're displaying something like VHS, or you're displaying something like of the time, it must be displayed in that format.
In the original format.
In the original format. So we'll have CRT monitors, we'll have all the original stuff. Now, what they've done is they've taken decommissioned Amiga 1000s, which I'm not sure what decommissioned means.
Ones that are not used anymore. I
don't know, but someone could have just looked at it and gone, oh, that's decommissioned. You know, there's no official kind of line with that. They could have all been repairable. And these things are incredibly rare. So what they've done is they've taken the Amiga 1000, they've taken the lovely CRT out, and they've replaced it with a LCD screen.
See, now that fits my definition of budget it.
Yeah, for me it does. They've also kind of put internals inside for a PC.
So they've ripped out the Amiga's motherboard.
They've ripped out the Amiga's motherboard, which, to be fair, as you said to me, they could have just replaced the capacitors on the motherboard and it would have lasted a very long time.
Probably longer than a modern PC board. I mean, generally, you know, since like lead-free solder came in and stuff's made a lot more disposable now. I mean, I think the average PC motherboard for me normally gets a bit flaky after about 5 years.
Yeah.
Whereas I've got, you know, hardware from the 80s still that runs great. You got to do a bit of maintenance on it, like you said, recapping it, you know, maybe a new power supply in there. But they've essentially took out all the original hardware.
Now, this isn't the first time that this has kind of happened with this group. It's the Carnegie Mellon University Computer Group.
This group, it's Ion Tank. This is a website that we're looking on here, isn't
it? Yeah. And basically, I remember they had a project where they were trying to get the disks and get the original images off the disks. And there's this great piece of hardware that everyone knows called Cryoflux, where you can just do it very quickly.
What's that do then, Cryoflux?
Cryoflux just takes a disk image off anything.
Yeah.
Any old school disk.
Regardless of the format.
Yeah, straight away. And has a great program for doing it and is like the standard. They built all these crazy custom PCs, spent thousands of pounds on it. So yeah, they've kind of got a history of this madness. And I think it's crazy because they've said they want it to be used all day.
Yeah.
So they've set up an emulator on there to recreate the slow disk access and lag of the program. But I know for a fact that at NASA, they kept Amigas on for 15 years.
Yeah, well, they ran
constantly, every day. They were processing planets
and
the maps of planets. And yeah, to kind of say that, oh no, it's not going to last, it kind of, I think it just shows a bit of lack of knowledge.
Ignorance.
Regarding the computer. And I know some people are going to say, oh, this looks like a nice job actually, and they've done a nice conversion. But no, displayed in CRT, that's what I think.
I think if there were no Amiga 1000s left in the world,
that
would be a great way to do it. I mean, looking at it as a hardware mod, they've done a very good job.
How many museums have you been to in the UK where they've got all the original hardware that are running and there's no problem and they've got them on all day?
Oh, there are museums dedicated to that.
Yeah,
retro game
exactly.
Museums all around the world.
Exactly. So I don't know why they've done this.
It does seem a bit weird. I mean, there have been some people who've been like, you know, in forums and stuff saying maybe they got like an arts kind of grant and they had to spend the money. I don't know how it works.
Yeah, I think the American art model is very different to the UK's because, of course, we're publicly funded.
Yeah.
And then our art model's very different to Germany, where they've got huge public funding on art. So, you know, there's different scales. It's all private investors in America, isn't it? So,
but being guys that respect the legacy of machines, and, you know, we love the Amiga, we've made no secret of that on the show before, it does kind of pain me to see that they've essentially ripped out the internals and the soul of that machine and put
like...
And
they're not even using the original keyboard either.
Yeah, it's a different keyboard. It's an Amiga 2000 keyboard they got there as well. So I think, you know, it would have been so easy just to use the original hardware. I just think it's unnecessary. So I'm sure there'll be people that think different. But if you want to find out more about that, I mean, looking at it, it does look like a good mod. They've done it well for what they've done. The bastards. So we'll put a link in the show notes at theretrohour.com if you can take the pain of looking at it. Now, tell us about this Halo TV series, then. What's been happening here?
Halo, that's a bit too modern for our podcast, isn't it?
2001. 21st century.
Yeah. Halo is very interesting because Halo was one of the first kind of machinima series. And do you know what machinima is, Dan?
Not really.
Machinima is making a film using a video game. So people who make these films in GTA 5, who make these films in the Source Engine and all of this kind of stuff. Well, it looks like Showtime are actually going to do a digital series called Halo Nightfall. And I find that's quite interesting. I've seen there's been lots of films about Halo. But the original series was called Red vs. Blue.
Okay.
And that was literally, like, I think it's up to season 17 or 18. It was by Rooster Teeth, who are a really big kind of, blogging site, and they have lots of channels.
Was that like a Halo spin-off, like, series then on YouTube, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was kind of a comic, yeah, science fiction web series, they called it. And it's really old. And it was premiered in 2003.
Before YouTube, then.
So I remember actually going to a Machinima festival and seeing this up on the screen. And I'm sure there's a lot of people that can actually tell me a lot more about it. But I found it really interesting that there's now a full commissioned Showtime television series coming out when the fans were kind of doing it in 2003.
Well, there has been talk about a proper, like, Halo series like this for many years. I mean, I'm looking at this article here on The Verge, and they're talking about, they were talking about this back in 2013. Apparently in collaboration with Steven Spielberg at the time, that was part of their Xbox Live plans. Because I know Xbox now, it's obviously more than just a gaming brand. They've got, like, video on there and their own, like, trying to be a bit like Netflix, I guess.
Yeah, and it's really interesting, the story of Halo, because that kind of came from Bungie,
yeah,
which came from the Mac. You know, so yeah, it's a real weird kind of development how Halo became the lead title coming out for the Xbox.
And was it Halo Nightfall as well by Ridley Scott? I mean, Halo's a big franchise though as well. And
huge.
It is, I mean, yeah, you look at it, it's kind of like something like Stargate or Star Trek. You get a lot out of it.
How many retro shows have you been to and Master Chief is walking past you?
If I see just one Master Chief at a retro gaming show, I'm surprised. There's always a few around. But it does look good. I mean, apparently there's going to be 10 episodes of this. So it is coming up soon. I think, it is, you could get a lot out of the Halo franchise.
Yeah, and I think you should kind of look back at the Red and Blue and the Machinima stuff, because that's really interesting.
Well, they're on YouTube now, so if you want to find those, I'll put them. And the rest of the stories that we've talked about on our website, theretrohour.com, in this week's show notes. And this was a nice little find. Ada Lovelace, for people who might not know who she is, give us a bit of background on Ada.
Ada Lovelace is the daughter of actually the local Lord Byron, who presided at Newstead Abbey. And she was far, 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 far ahead of her time, basically.
Like 200 years ahead of her time.
Yeah, she was digitally programming 200 years ago, thinking of all these things before computers actually came out. And she worked with Charles Babbage,
yeah,
who did the Difference Engine, which was one of the first computers, really. And this book contains the world's first computer algorithm.
Now, this book is 175 years old.
175 years old, yeah. And it's an absolute piece of history, this is.
So essentially talking about the first written down computer code.
Yeah.
The first program.
Yeah, the first program. Yeah, and you can actually see the computer code on some of these things. And the way that they've done it is it's all kind of individual switches with the Difference Engine. You can actually go to the London Science Museum and see part of the Difference Engine. And it's just insane that people were thinking this far ahead. Can you imagine there's going to be someone walking around at the moment who's writing something that's far beyond us, you know, that maybe in 175 years it may be sold for thousands?
Well, this has recently gone on auction. That's the reason we're talking about it in the news. It sold for £95,000. So that's $125,000. Which, you know, for something that's so historically significant, is actually not a bad price, really.
Yeah, for something published in 1843.
Yeah, and this was just found in a box of books owned by a couple in the Cotswolds, apparently.
Oh, so. Well, I think everybody should watch any of the films and documentaries on Ada Lovelace, because, you know, she was pretty much the inventor of computer programming. And it's great, you know, they say there's not that many women in tech. Well, a lot of women were the computers...
Pioneers, really,
originally, yeah, yeah, and absolutely. Were also programming before.
And she died at 36. I mean, she was very young. You know, she did all this in her 20s.
Well, probably hanging around with Lord Byron, you know.
Rubbed off a bit.
Yeah.
So if you want to have a look more about that, I mean, she's very interesting. And you've put me onto a few, like, movies and documentaries about her in the past as well. So we'll link those up as well. Now, before we get into our interview with Roger Hulley, would you say you're addicted to video games? It's not a nice phrase, is it, addiction?
I wasn't addicted. Maybe as a teenager, I was addicted to going home, chatting to my friends on the thing, and kind of the community. I was probably addicted to that more than
IRC.
Yeah, IRC, but also on TeamSpeak and stuff like that.
Well, what's quite interesting is they've now said that video game addiction has been recognised as a real condition. So this is the World Health Organization who've called it gaming disorder. And apparently now it's been registered in the International Classification of Diseases, saying that it is possible to be addicted to video games. Now, reading that, that's not a surprise, because it's possible to get addicted to anything.
Yeah, and, you know, I hear it's really bad in Japan and China, and they've actually had, you know, detox programs. I saw a very horrible documentary about how they were doing electrolysis on people for addiction and stuff. I think that's not right. Mm. But, you know, I think treating it as an actual illness is a good way to go about it.
I think there's a difference, though. I mean, you can play something a lot and not be addicted to it, but there is a difference. I mean, I guess it's the stage when it's completely taken over your life at the expense of other things.
But also, they're designed to be addictive.
Yeah.
You know, so it's easy to fall into that trap, you know, especially with, like, what, Candy Crush and all these ones where you get, like, rewards for gaming, or even World of Warcraft and stuff like that. Those are designed to hook you in and designed to make you play as long as possible. So I'm really not surprised that people are falling into, you know, bad ways when it comes to video games.
And I guess, you know, now, because games are so big and you've got these massive online communities as well, where you can essentially live in them 24/7.
Yeah, exactly.
If,
yeah.
If you can, you know.
I did for a couple of years, yeah.
I remember that time, Ravi, yeah. And a massive beard. Took your virtual reality head. What year is this? Robin Williams.
Massive belly.
Well, it goes without saying. But, I mean, I guess it is a serious thing. I mean, and anyone can get addicted to anything if you've got the right mindset for it, I suppose.
Totally. And if they're designed to trigger all those endorphins in your brain, then, you know.
But again, I mean, it's better than being addicted to gambling or smoking or alcohol or something, I guess, isn't it? You know, in many
Crack.
Ways. Crack. Yeah, it could be a lot worse. But I think it's like anything. You've got to have a healthy balance. I wish I had time to get addicted to video games.
Yeah, all we do is talk about video games now. That's the cure for video games addiction. Do a podcast.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't played a game for about 3 years. So if you don't want to read more, it is an interesting article, and I know opinions will fall both sides of the fence on that one, but we'll put a link to that in this week's show notes as well. And that is, of course, a place where you can check out our back catalogue, because we do get people who often say to us, why don't you get this guy in the podcast? And we're like, oh, episode 36.
That's it. Well, I'm at the moment, I'm working on a big guest page where every single guest is going to have a face, and you can click on that and then straight to their episode. So.
Yeah, 133 guests is a lot.
Yeah, I've got to process that all manually. It's going to be great for...
Oh, that'll be a fun. I was going to say weekend, month.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you can check out our back catalogue. I mean, there are so many interesting guests that we've had on the podcast. If you do have a spare couple of weeks, have a little look back at theretrohour.com, the same place that you can get our social media links as well. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, our Discord channel as well, where we do hang out and chat about video games when we're not talking about them on the podcast. So you've got all of those on our website. Definitely worth checking them out. And if you do listen on any podcast clients, please do keep your reviews coming in as well. They always really help get the show in front of new people. Right then, should we talk about budget games back in the day, school days, back to the 80s? This week's special guest, all about alternative software, is Roger Hulley. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time to welcome this week's special guest. Going to find out all about the days of alternative software, classics like school days getting reinvented for the 21st century. Welcome to the show, Roger Hulley.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Now, before we get into all that, Roger, I mean, it's always nice to get a little bit of background on, you know, what made you tick back in the day. I mean, do you remember what kind of first got you interested in the video games industry and where your kind of journey and all that started?
Yes, well, when I left university, although I got a degree in biological sciences, at that particular stage in time, I was getting really into music and big time. I was writing for rock fanzines and things like this. And I was thinking, like a student, I wanted to get a job where I could take home any music on a night. This is well before the days of iTunes, etc. And I thought an ideal situation would be if I could land a job working for someone like HMV. At that particular stage in time, HMV was owned by EMI, and I became, luckily enough, I got to the position of graduate trainee with EMI, and they moved me about all over the place, and eventually I got into the HMV side of EMI and ran certain stores and things, and I was poached by another record chain, And I ran that record chain at the same time I started introducing video into that record, into the record stores there. In those days, music record shops were purely that. They sold records, they sold music-related items such as T-shirts and badges, things like that, and patches, but nothing more than that. And when video first came along, I thought, great, let's see if we can turn this more into an entertainment center. And I introduced video. And then from that, I started bringing in Atari VCS cartridges. And then I got the thoughts of why not start selling computers, i.e. the entertainment side, not the big bulky jobs that were around at the time. And I put in Atari 400XLs, I think I've got that right, if I remember correctly, and Atari VCS consoles, of course. And from that on, from that time onwards, I got the bug for computer games, because it was a little bit like having a, like the old days of music when, you know, you had a hit record,
yeah,
and, you know, you started off with nothing and bingo, you were climbing the charts. So I got the bug and I decided to pack in my day job and start to get involved in the computer games industry.
So when you first saw this kind of emerging new industry, I mean, it must have seemed, I mean, did it seem like something that was going to be around for a long time, or did it seem a bit like a fad that might kind of fade out after a couple of years?
No, I felt it was going to be around for a long time, and I obviously I'd been playing a lot of cartridge games at that particular stage in time, and I could see the entertainment value, and I just thought, you know, this is not going to go away. In fact, what I thought was obviously it'll get bigger and bigger and bigger, which clearly it has done, and that was basically what was ticking through my mind when I decided to pack in my day job.
Well, did you have to strike a deal with Atari then?
Yes, I did. Funnily enough, I had to raise a lot of money to open an account with Atari and Activision in those days. So much so, I robbed the piggy bank and borrowed money wherever I could. And I bought in at that particular stage at the time a lot of cartridge games. And then from then onwards, I started selling those. And then that's how I got really working, shall we say, in the computer games, video games market.
Well, were you a games player yourself, like after work?
Occasionally, yes. When I started getting the games on the VCS cartridges, I used to obviously enjoy banging away on things like Berserk, Pitfall, Yar's Revenge, Frogger. Well, you name them all. I was enjoying playing those particular games, and I could see the entertainment value therein. Prior to that, obviously, in the old days before then, I played on them at nightclubs on things like Pong when it first came through. I can go back that far, as the case is. And when computer games started coming through as improper, I obviously enjoyed playing those particular games. And one that always sticks in my mind is a very simple game but called Mule. And I really enjoyed playing that at that time. It was obviously something that stimulated me to thinking, well, why can't we, or I, start doing computer games as original products, etc., as the case is.
So we all kind of know about Britsoft and the kind of revolution of like homemade games there. How did you end up getting your games and then choosing which ones to distribute?
Right, well, when I was in the music industry, there was a label called MFP, which is Music for Pleasure, and what that used to do was basically republish albums. And I thought, at that particular stage in time, a lot of product was coming out at full price, but nobody was thinking about republishing it. There was a label out there called Mastertronic, and they were bringing out original products, and I just thought there was an opportunity to create a label where it would involve basically taking hits or minor hits and then republishing them at a lower price point. And that's what I started off doing. Although the very first title that we put out there was a game called Henry's Horde, which had been a program by a programmer called Martin Brown, who subsequently went on to form Team 17. And that was the first game that appeared on the Alternative Software label. But after that, we started getting heavily involved in republishing.
So when you were republishing, were you kind of repackaging the whole thing, adding new labels, making it appeal to a different market than the original ones?
Yeah, correct. We actually got a small grant from the Design Council to redesign what the pack would be and the logo. and we started working on the precipice on the idea that we would put these out at a lower price point, i.e. $199. And we went from there, and one of the first games we put out was a cricket game. It wasn't particularly good, but it was a cricket game called How's That? And I remember we tried to sell it into WH Smith, and they said no. And at that particular stage in time, it was around about Christmas, and for some reason, England did particularly well down under. And then we got a phone call from WH Smith saying, yeah, we'll take that particular game, and we put that into their stores. And then we basically established a relationship with WH Smith, and we put in quite a lot of our titles at that particular stage in time.
Well, people kind of forget how incredibly important the packaging was back then. You know, we had Bob Wakelin on, who did a lot of the art for Ocean, and it was really to kind of attract people's attention. What kind of things did you do to get people, you know, noticing your games, other than the price point as well, which was great?
Well, we had the design of the actual packaging, what the layout was going to be, and we commissioned artists to actually, create the pictures that would hopefully portray the game as the content would be. Obviously, screenshots appeared on the back, but we wanted to make the front as dynamic as possible. And I think we succeeded. Well, clearly we did. And when we relaunched games that had been previously out, quite often the covers weren't particularly exciting in some instances. And we went to town on those, and we gave them a complete new look. And because they were fresh and they were priced at the price point that we put them out at, people did go for them.
I mean, I remember being a kid, and buying, cassette tapes for my Commodore, and being a kid that didn't have much pocket money, being able to get games for like that $1.99 price range. I mean, that was really the only way that we could afford games, unless it was Christmas or birthday. So I imagine you had a massive potential market there.
Yes, there was. One time we were 17% of the budget market. I can go back to a particular time when we did our first show as Alternative Software, and I think we had 7 titles in the top 25. And it was crazy.
I mean, obviously there was you and Mastertronic. I mean, was there like much rivalry there with you two?
Not with ourselves and Mastertronic, no. And there was Codemasters as well. Basically, it was the three of us. There were smaller labels that were around, like Atlantis, etc. And there are others, which obviously I can list, but for the sake of your viewers and readers, listeners, should I say, I will not go through a massive list of the software companies that were around at that particular stage in time. But the three main ones in the budget sector, I would say, were Mastertronic, Codemasters, and ourselves.
So being at that price point, it must have been kind of hard to get the maximum amount of kind of profit out of it and keep the product good. What techniques did you use?
Well, it was when we were purchasing, obviously repurchasing, should I say, to relaunch. We were committed to obviously creating a dynamic cover and getting it out there into the marketplace, to the main retailers, so we could create some volume on the sales. It was all about getting the volume when you're working on such tight margins as we were then. We did then eventually put out a $2.99 price point as well. Really heady price there. And we created a label called Summit, which we were putting out games that we were acquiring from labels like PSS, games like Theatre Europe, Spitfire 40, games that were a little bit more, I should say, in depth. And we started putting those on that particular label, and we were putting those prices out to $2.99. Eventually, we did step up to $2.99 for most of the budget titles, but at the price point, we originally started off at $1.99.
Well, that was an interesting name for the company as well, Summit, because that was a game previously, wasn't it?
Summit was a card game that my father invented back in the 30s. And he invented this particular card game, and I just thought that would make a great name for a label, obviously. Bit of nostalgia there. But the Summit was called was spelled S-U-M-I-T, with a hyphen in between. And that, we put it out at Summit with a nice mountain scene, etc., etc. And it was the reason why I called that particular label Summit.
Well, I remember being a kid and getting Phoenix. It was a massive arcade game, and I know you guys you released that, didn't you, on home platforms?
We did. It was a one man band. The label was called Mega Dodo, and it was trickling along quite nicely. And I decided that with a revamp and a repush, putting it out at $1.99, it would do well. And we acquired it from the developer at that particular stage in time, and we put it out. And it did very well. It was spelled slightly different because in those days, copyrights wasn't really a problem, shall we say. It wasn't raising, everybody wasn't as protective at that particular stage in time. So we put this game out called Phoenix. It was spelled with spelled deliberately incorrectly.
Double E, wasn't it? Yeah,
double E. And Crash, and I think it was Crash in particular, loved the game. And they'd given it really good reviews when it came out at a price point, which was probably about $6.95, I would think. And then we put it out at $1.99. It did very, very well.
Yeah, because I had it on. I mean, I had a Commodore Plus 4, and there wasn't a lot of good software for that platform, but I used to play that game so much because it was such a quality, well-written version of it as well. I mean, having the fact that you could get arcade games at home for that price point was something I'd never seen before that.
Yes, indeed, yeah. I mean, There were people were doing derivatives of classic video games at that stage in time. They're giving them all sorts of strange names, of course. Things have settled down now, of course, which is great.
I heard you were out of frustration. You also bought a lot of duplicating equipment. So was that a big task to go around setting all that up and getting the kind of duplication going?
Gosh, haven't you? Yeah. Yes. At one particular stage in time, we were doing, because we were masked, we were going for volume. We realised that it would be sensible to actually do our own duplication as well. So the opportunity came along to buy a duplicator, and we purchased that particular duplicator, set it up in our building at that particular stage in time, and we started duplicating our own cassettes and for other companies as well, because other companies then came to us and we did their duplication as well.
Why did you decide to do it yourself then? Was it just like, were the other duplicators too busy, or were they letting you down? Or?
Well, really, the opportunity arose because this particular company, which was a paint company, decided that this little side operation they had, which was duplication, wasn't really their main thrust, and we were using them. So we thought they were going to pull out of the market. We thought, well, great. Well, not great, but we thought, well, this is an opportunity for us to control our own destiny. So we thought of the fact that we like to think that we got the vertical, the full vertical of it. We acquired the games. We also developed them as well, of course, by this stage in time. We can manufacture them, which is obviously keeping our costs tight, and then we can distribute them. And that's the way we thought about it. It was like a vertical situation. We wanted to control all aspects of the process.
I mean, I know one side, one downside about the cassette tape as a format was that piracy was very easy on it.
Correct.
I mean, every kid at school probably had a friend who had a tape-to-tape copier. I mean, having a budget label as well, I mean, did that affect you guys a lot then when piracy became more prevalent?
Yes, it did. We would find that we would sell, obviously, increasingly less quantity as a result of piracy. But, it's just one of those things we had to take on the chin.
Yeah, it was remarkable that even like people pirate a £2 game. So,
I'm staggered. Yeah. That they do, and they still do today.
Yeah,
which we'll get people asking us for keys for a certain game, and it's only out at a very, very cheap price. And you're thinking, well, if you're that interested in the product, why not buy it? Yeah. But it does surprise you the fact that people will want to copy something that even if it is put out at a very competitive price point.
Well, getting back to the 8-bit days, I mean, what was your relationship like with the magazines in the UK? Because I know they were extremely important back then, weren't they?
Yes, they were. Because we were seen to be a budget software house, I sometimes didn't think we got the fair crack of the whip. But we did have. Some titles which we eventually created, obviously, and developed ourselves. And those particular titles, we got some mixed reviews, of course, everybody did, but we got some great reviews as well. So we had to, that was it. That's the way it worked.
Did you get any kind of licensing agreements with any, like, famous trademarks? I saw there was a picture of you with Thomas the Tank Engine at one point.
Yes, that was very much the case. What happened was that... Whilst we were bringing out the republishing of games, and deciding then at that particular stage in time to get involved in our own development of games. My son was very young at that particular stage in time, and what I wanted to do was think about games that he would play. And when I looked around, the only titles that were really significant out there were things like the Mr. Men series by Mirrorsoft, and they were retailing around $10.99, which was a lot of money. And I thought that from a parent's point of view, you know, you don't know what if your child is going to enjoy the game, and you don't want to be investing that sort of sum. So I thought that if we put out children's games at $1.99, there could be a marketplace. So we approached Britt Allcroft, who at that time owned Thomas the Tank Engine. She turned us down first. So we then went to see the BBC, who controlled Postman Pat through Woodland Animations. And we got the license to do Postman Pat. We put Postman Pat out at $1.99, and I think it was like number one for 6 months, something like that, on the budget market. It did very well. We got an award for it. And we then went back to Thomas Tank Engine, Britt Allcroft, and they said yes, because they originally turned it down because they thought that all computer games were violent, and obviously that wasn't the way we were going to portray those particular characters. And they could see what we did with Thomas, with Postman Pat, and thought, yeah, why not? So we acquired the license for Thomas Tank Engine, and then we acquired other licenses, classic British characters like Sooty and Sweep, the Wombles, Huxley Pig, I'm trying to think of them.
You did Count Duckula as well, didn't you?
Yeah, we did Count Duckula, because we had done Danger Mouse, which we'd acquired from Creative Sparks when Creative Sparks went under. So we had Danger Mouse out there, so we then thought about Cosgrove Hall, and we went to pick up the license for Count Duckula.
And they were big cartoons, and I mean, you've got to think, then we had four channels on TV. You know, that they got millions and millions of viewers at tea time, these shows. So, I mean, I guess in terms of an advert for the game, that must have been invaluable.
Indeed, it was. And that was one of the reasons why we got involved in licensing, because we thought, from a marketing point of view, we could start throwing money at marketing and hopefully trying to get a product that was, you know, shall we say, that was unknown to a situation where it would be taken up by the general public. But the other logic to that was, well, why not get a license where the marketing to a certain degree has been done for you? People would know about that particular character or characters. And that's one of the reasons why we got involved heavily in licensing.
And I guess, like, kids would go and buy a full title really expensively. Their parents would give it to them. But if they were going out as a consumer themselves and buying something, it would be something that they've been watching on TV all the time. So they might be able to pester their parents more or kind of, you know, buy it themselves.
Yeah, pester power obviously came in. Yes, it was good, that respect. And, of course, parents didn't really mind if it was the price points that we were putting the games out at, because, you know, they were very competitively priced, and you got one heck of a lot of entertainment for your $1.99.
I mean, a bit later on, you kind of moved into like kind of serious software as well. You did like a paint studio product as well in the 90s.
We did. We actually, one of our first products was a paint studio. We did a product called Artmaster, which we put out under the Summit label. And we moved away from that, you know, concentrated on games. And then I can't remember exactly how it happened now. We had the Thomas Tank Engine license, and we were thinking of other things we could do other than games. It came to mind that why not do an everlasting colouring book? Now, these things are obviously well produced now, but at that particular stage in time, there was nothing around there. So we created this electronic, as we called it, paint and create type product. And we did that for Thomas Tank Engine, and then we did it for other character licenses as well. And, of course, it worked well with children's licensing.
Well, you mentioned kind of characters there, and the game that we're going to be talking about is your remastered version of School Days, and it really reminded me of the kind of Bass Street Kids and the, you know, the Beano, Grange Hill kind of style of characters, and really fit into that time period as well.
Yeah. When we repackaged School Days, we bought Microsphere's back catalogue, the full catalogue, and because Dave Reedy and Helen Reedy were not wanting to continue, so we purchased their full catalogue, and with that came the classic School Days and Back to School. And at the time, I remember Dave Reedy said to me, "Well, you know, we've already put it out on budget because Elite had done it, And I said, well, I think we could take it again and put it out and get more from it. And we did. We repackaged it. We gave it a, I guess you would say, a Beano West look. And we put it out at $1.99, and it did phenomenally well. And then we followed that up with Back to School, and that did phenomenally well as well.
Well, the really interesting thing I find is kind of you guys have been doing this for 30 years and you're still around. Have you seen a renewed interest in these like classic titles and games?
Yeah, retro seems to be pretty hot now. We've been around 33 years, actually.
Oh.
Yeah, retro is pretty hot now. The C64, is it? The Mini?
Yeah.
That came through. You've got obviously lots of, Sinclair Spectrum type retro machines coming through. Some are successful, some of them are falling by the wayside, whichever. But quite clearly, they're hungry for titles. And in addition to that, you are seeing certain games that are appearing now. I would say Escapists would be a classic example, which seems to be going back to a retro feel. And there are other games as well of that ilk. So, I think retro is back in a big way, and hopefully we can, we can basically benefit from that.
What, in your opinion, made School Days such an iconic title?
Oh, it was a brilliant game. I mean, the fact that, you could walk around and do what you want. You didn't have to actually play the whole game from getting task A to task B to task C, game over. You could wander around. It was one of the first sandbox games. Mm. And I think, obviously, kids at the time used to enjoy chalking strange things on blackboards and things like that and changing names of teachers, and that as the case would be. And, of course, it related to the people who were buying the game. I mean, they were at school, the vast majority thereof, and you were playing a game called School Days and within a school environment, clearly. It ticked a lot of boxes. And, I thought the game itself was well ahead of its time.
Yeah, and I think you made a really good point there, because the kids that were playing it, you could do all the things in the game that you really wanted to do at school, but you couldn't get away with. You get detention. So
absolutely,
that was always good.
Yeah, I couldn't have shot the maths teacher with a pea shooter.
With a catapult. No, you couldn't. No, you couldn't. If you did, I don't think you'd have been at school very long.
Well, you mentioned the sequel there, Back to School, as well. I mean, what was kind of the thinking with that then to expand on the original?
Well, Back to School obviously was what Dave Reedy and Helen Reedy had done. I mean, they'd followed up School Days with their own sequel. Mm. And I think they brought girls into it, as the case.
There's a girls' school next door, wasn't there? Yeah.
Haley. And and that game obviously was a logical progression, I think, from School Days. And people loved that game. In fact, some people preferred it to School Days. But I think the Guardian, the Telegraph, did some research or an article just relatively recently, a few years ago, and they put School Days and Back to School in the top 10 British games of all time. So, we're not alone in thinking they were great.
So when you originally thought we're going to kind of remake School Days, were you worried that you might ruin a classic and you have to kind of really handle it with care?
There is an element of that, yes. We were going to go down a particular route, and then we got talking to a development team that were based in Spain, and they had got a game concept together, and we looked at that, and we said, well, let's run with this one. So we thought that if we are going to revisit School Days, the first instance ought to be a retro homage to the originals, and that is what I think we've achieved with Reschooled.
Yeah, because with those games, I mean, not only are you updating the game itself, but also it's people's memories as well, isn't it?
It is. And obviously, what we're finding is that people are buying this game so they can play it on modern-day devices, rather than going through the painful process of trying to, get a Spectrum game to work on XYZ. Although you can buy the game as an original Spectrum game with an emulator on iTunes. But which is all licensed by ourselves. But effectively, we thought, people would want to play the game and remember it from their heady days when they were young, etc., and they can enjoy it again.
Well, you've introduced different levels as well, like new school and school rules and stuff. So how interesting was it doing the modern schools?
Well, the idea was we would put out the game school days, we would then make sure that alongside it was back to school. And we thought, well, a third game in there would be good, something in the same vein, the same keeping the retro feel. So we created New School, spelt deliberately wrong, and as like a third game within the game, so to speak. So we felt that if we did all those, we gave people the originals but revamped them, and we gave them a new modern feel and look. And then, in addition to that, we also gave them an added extra, i.e., another game. And hopefully, that would that would sell.
And it's kind of added massive longevity into the game because you can complete each one now. You know.
Yes.
And it's still a budget title as well. Actually, it's a really good price point.
It is. It is. We thought we wouldn't put this out at a higher price point. We would put this out at a reasonable, affordable price. And hopefully, people would take it, and we would sell several units, inverted commas.
Yeah, because the thing is, when you're doing remakes, I mean, some of them work, some of them don't. But I think with this, you kept all the charm of the original game as well, which is really important. And the fact that it's kind of got that pick up and play element of the original, you haven't got to sit there like a lot of modern games for like 18 hours and complete every bit of it. You can just explore and have fun with it too. So
yeah, too right. Exactly what we wanted to achieve, actually. That's exactly what we wanted to achieve. And it would appear from the reviews that we're getting is that people think likewise as well.
And having little elements like the rainbow stripes in the menu as well. Yeah, that kind
the
of
spectrum.
Yeah, it totally triggers nostalgia.
Yeah, and you'll find there's a there's even a spectrum noise in there as well, which we put in as one of the sound effects.
Oh, so people will hear that and suddenly be transported back.
Yeah. But I think even if you've never played School Days before, and you've never heard of it, quite clearly, a sizable chunk of people will fall into that sector. You'll still enjoy the game because it's it really will appeal to new as well as old.
We get that when we do retro gaming events and shows. I mean, you often get like dads there with the daughters and sons and showing them the games that they played on and introducing like a new audience to it as well. I guess there's quite a lot of that in it too.
It is. I mean, when you think about the games that we were doing back in the 80s, etc., you didn't have the capabilities to produce all the fantastic graphics and almost, create a cinema effect. You really were dependent upon the playability of the game. That was all you could really fall back on and the addictiveness of it. So, because consequently, those games are hopefully, and would appear to be the case, coming back in one way, in so much that, they've got that, I must have another go feel.
Well, now you can actually play it on mobile, so you can play School Days in school. What were the challenges with getting it on that kind of mobile interface compared to a traditional keyboard?
Yeah, obviously we had to come up with a way that people could move about in the game. We've got like a dummy joystick actually on screen for the mobile versions, and we've got like a graphic of a fist so that when you're hitting things, you see that element that come up, and to get the idea of going up and down as well, we had to come up with I think with a way that really works actually. If you do actually play the game on mobile, you'll see that. That dummy joystick in the corner, which basically helps.
Well, you were talking before about these kind of new platforms, like we've got the Spectrum Next and, the C64 and stuff like that. Mm. I mean, are there any plans to put it on, like, these new platforms, these new retro platforms?
We haven't thought about that yet. The original games are out there, of course, on those platforms, yeah. Which we've licensed. I think it would be an opportunity, obviously, that we would look at in the future to put them out there. Yes, it all depends on the operating system of those particular machines.
It still blows my mind that you can walk into Argos now and buy a new C64, though.
Yeah, it's a cute little thing as well, the fact that it looks like a Commodore 64, but obviously a much smaller version. Obviously, you have to connect a keyboard up to it but to get the full effect, but, it's a little... I'm actually staring at one now. It is a very, very attractive item.
So have you seen kind of other companies coming through at the moment? Because we know Houston Consultants has started doing a few things. And, it must be interesting kind of seeing a Spectrum scene emerging again.
It is. And I hope it establishes itself to such an extent that we can bring out more and revisit our back catalogue even, in more in-depth, shall we say. Yeah. There's Houston out there. I think I'm trying to think of others, but off the top of my head. But I mean, we've been around 33 years. I think we're the longest established independent British software publisher.
Yeah, it's a long time, 33 years.
Yeah, it is. Tell me about it.
I mean, how do you find it differs today?
Distribution's hard, if anything, because there are fewer retailers. So the competitive nature out there used to be the fact that, you know, if a new release came out, if you were a retailer, you had to have it. You know, it literally was. If you didn't have that new release in and the shop down the road did, you would lose customers. But now there are very few high street stores around in comparison to the years gone by.
You mentioned your back catalogue there as well. Would there be any titles that you particularly want to remake or, you know, upgrade?
Yes, there are. There are several I would like to put out there. Some of which, you know, your listeners may be aware of. There was a game that we put out called High Steel. I'd like to bring that out again. One of my favourites. I'd like to revisit some of the children's games that we put out there and get those out into the modern world again. There's quite a few, actually, but without going through a huge list. I mean, there's some of the titles from Microsphere, of course. Wheelie was a great little game, but it would have to be really stepped up.
You know, talking about 33 years of alternative software, I mean, have you still got, like, a lot of the original stuff, like the old tapes and computers and stuff around?
We've got a good selection thereof, but back in 1997, we were situated in Pontefract and our next-door neighbours unfortunately had a fire.
Oh, no way.
And what that did was it spread into our units and destroyed lots of our stock. So we were devastated at that particular stage in time. We actually operated at one time with a tarpaulin for a wall throughout that particular winter. But so we lost a lot of units, etc., and a lot of our masters and things like that. But we've managed to get, you know, to get back with most of the masters. And in addition to that, obviously we've got a smaller selection of games that we previously put out.
Yeah, I was going to say it must be interesting looking through those archives.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Every now and then, somebody will remind me of a title, and I'll pick it up and think, "Oh yeah, have we still got a copy of that?" And then to find it and think, "Gosh, I remember that the years when we were doing that." I'm staring at a title now, Trapdoor, which we acquired from Piranha and Don Priestley, and through the Trapdoor and Trapdoor, and that was a fantastic title.
Well, Roger, you know, we can't think of any other company in the UK that's been around for 33 years in the gaming industry. You know, one of the fastest changing industries in the world as well. So it is testament to Alternative and you that you've managed to change with the times and you've got such a loyal fan base as well. And long may it continue.
I hope so. Fingers crossed. Touch wood.
And if people want to keep up to date with you then, you've got a website, you're online, all that kind of thing?
Yeah, we have our website, of course, at www.alternativesoftware.com. And we obviously now, well, we're still publishing games. The latest game, as you picked up on, was the retro homage, School Days Reschooled. We have our rugby titles as well. Yeah, we've got Rugby Union Team Manager, Rugby League Team Manager games out there in the marketplace. In addition to that, we do have some console games that we work in conjunction with an Australian company. We put those out as well. And we do have several PC titles in development now that we hopefully will have out before Christmas. In addition to that, we do have mobile games coming through as well.
Excellent. Well, I'll put a link to your website in our show notes if people want to check out your catalogue, what's happening at the moment.
Yeah, please do. And we have Facebook pages for most of our games as well. And in fact, there's a Facebook page for School Days.
Well, Roger, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for the invite. I've really enjoyed it.
Luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths and sometimes heights to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.